Say when.
Okay, I think it's going. You ready? Yep, so this is Lexi Hartley. I'm interviewing Mr. Jerry Jemian today on behalf of the National Historic Park. It's August 8th, 2013. It's around 10 o'clock a.m., and we're at the VFW post in Montville Township, New Jersey, and we're accompanied by my grandfather and Jerry's friend, Al Morocco. Okay, so the first question I'm going to start, where and when were you born?
I was born in New London, Connecticut, in the United States, and it was on August the 25th, 1922.
Okay, and then did you stay in New London, or did your family
move? No, we left New London in 1925, and we relocated in Paterson, New Jersey.
Okay, why did you guys relocate to Paterson?
My parents were both experts in silk weaving, and Paterson, New Jersey at the time became the silk center of the world. So we relocated to Paterson, New Jersey, where the work was. That was in 1925, and at the time I was 3 years old.
Okay, so were your parents born in the U.S.?
No, their parents were born in Turkey. They were born in a small village at the bottom of the mountain called Musada, literally translated means Mountain of Moses. It was in the north of, what's the name of that town? Stop. And what was prominent in the birthplace of my mother and father, the town, the little village that they live in was one of seven villages at the bottom of this huge mountain, Musada. What was prominent about that was during the Turkish massacres in the 1915-1917 era, 1918, so forth and so on, was that these villagers, in their primitive way, decided to oppose the Turkish army and retreated to the top of the mountain of Musada and set up fortifications and fought the Turkish people, the Turkish army. Matter of fact, that story was historically reflected in the bestseller book 40 Days at Musada. The author was a German whose name was Franz Werfel, W-E-R-F-E-L. He captured the entire essence of the defense of these villagers at the top of the mountain, Musada. And there were 4,000 Armenian defenders there. Suffered casualties, of course, fighting the Turkish army, and they were rescued by the French, and French fleet was off course, supposed to be by the island of Holden, and the French fleet was off course on the island of Cyprus and saw the distress signal at the top of Musada. And they sent an investigative crew to find out what was going on. And when they learned of the Armenians' plight, the Armenians ran down the mountains and they were rescued by the French.
Were your parents?
That was my mother. I don't know historically what part my father played in this. I don't think, I don't know whether he was there or not. The records as we knew it were destroyed by the Turks. All the churches were burned. There were no records at all. So it's all word of mouth that was handed down from the previous generation to me, my generation. I am the first generation Armenian American in the United States. Shut it down.
So
now my mother migrated to the United States in 1921, and she came through the port of Marseille to Boston, Massachusetts, where she met my father, and they were married in 1922. based on hearsay, from what I can understand, aged Armenian people passing information down, my father must have entered the United States sometime in 1920 and settled in Worcester, Massachusetts. This is where it all started.
Did your mom's relatives come with her, or did
no, she came over.
By
she
herself?
Was a teenager, and let me back up a minute. She was a teenager at the Battle of Musada, and then when they were rescued by the French, the refugees were transported to Port Said, Egypt, into a refugee camp. It was at this refugee camp that my mother, a young teenager, became a Red Cross nurse and ministered to the sick and the starving at this refugee camp. And it is believed it is at this refugee camp that she may have been exposed to tuberculosis, because she died of that tuberculosis when I was a little boy at 7 years old at 1927. Mm-hmm. As you know, medically we could not trace it back as effectively as we could today. But it was presumed that that's what happened to her.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, my great-grandmother died of tuberculosis in the 20s, too. Okay. So what was it like for your parents moving to the U.S.? What were their experiences moving to the U.S.?
Well first of all, you cannot imagine the relief and the thrill of living in a country that enjoyed the freedom that was unheard of in the world. They were absolutely dedicated to the United States of America, and instantly, took steps to become Americanized and become citizens. And I recall they tell me that they went to night school to try and learn the language. And when we talked at home in the kitchen, my parents always tried to advise me, to advise them what words became English that could be translated from the Armenian. That's how dedicated they were to be in the United States.
So you'd even speak English at home?
We spoke English as well as Armenian.
Okay, and did they have trouble finding a job when they first
No, they didn't. Because of their expertise in silk weaving, it was an instant connection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was their trade. My father at the time was running 16 looms in Patterson. It was located in downtown Patterson in the Ellison Street area. Ellison Street, Cross Street area was most of the mills were located in that area.
Okay, so they had learned weaving back in Armenia?
Oh, yeah. They used to weave rugs and sell them. That's how they made their portion of their living, was selling rugs.
Mm-hmm. And did they do this when they were in Boston at all, or?
I don't know what they did when they were in Boston, to tell you the truth. I know they were married in the Catholic mm-hmm. Church in East Boston in 1921, and I was born in 1922. But I understand that from Boston, they went to New London, Connecticut, where mm-hmm. I was born, and the reason why they went there was there was a prominent silk mill in that community, and they went there to get work. It's just like we did during the the defense industry, the industrial military industrial complex. Mm-hmm. You went where the work was. That was similar to what they did during their days for employment. It's going from community to community where work was. Go ahead.
Okay, so then they moved to Patterson.
Yeah, they moved to Patterson in 1925, and they relocated in South Patterson, New Jersey, on Main Street, opposite Madison Avenue. is where we first relocated. And during the next several years, we moved around from one section of community in Patterson to another section of community in South mm-hmm. Patterson. But we remained in South Patterson until 1935. And in 1935, during the Depression, we relocated to downtown Patterson on Cross and Ellison Street mm-hmm. to save bus fare.
Okay, so that was closer to their occupation.
Yeah.
What were their working, like, what were their specific jobs, and also what were their working conditions like?
Well, the working conditions in a silk mill at that time were horrible. They would work 12, 14, 16 hours a day. And I don't know what the rate of pay was. It wasn't very much, but they did have to work long hours.
So even as they came in with the skills, they still had to work long
absolutely.
Hours under bad conditions.
Yes. And there was a large Armenian community in South Patterson, New Jersey at the time, which has since been decimated through age attrition mm-hmm. and whatnot. It's no longer an Armenian community up that way.
So you had a lot of, like, Armenian friends growing up.
Oh, right? Yeah. We had. Yeah, we were very close, just like the Italians would be mm-hmm. in those days. And it was kind of secular in that in the community, each ethnic group stayed apart from other ethnic groups. The Italians mm-hmm. had their own circle. The Armenians had their own circle. The Irish had their own group, so forth and so on.
And did you ever, like, did you eventually end up interacting with people from other groups?
Yes. In those days, we were closer in other ethnic groups, more so than you are today. Because mm-hmm. it was a question of survival, and it was a question of interfacing with each group for whatever activities that we could perform together. It was more of a family sort of an activity, and not as it is today. Today, neighbors don't even talk to each other.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and in those days, we would sit outside on a porch and talk to everybody walking by, and we'd get together for picnics and cookouts and whatnot.
Yeah. Okay, so the big question about, I know your parents were involved in some union activity, so do you want to explain about that?
Yeah,
about that?
We got to back up. The interviewer is using plural and parents. And as I indicated to you earlier, my mother expired in 1927. So it was my father and it was his brother and my uncle were involved. There was no activity as you express in the interview, but let me back up now. What had happened because of the extraordinary harsh working conditions, union organizers had came into Patterson and started organizing union activity. And historically speaking, there was a very popular organizer who was located in Halden, the home where the first congregation of union activity is still there. Now,
the bottom house,
there was a huge strike in 1933. At the time, I was 10 years old, and I remember all the workers poured out of the mills and were gathered on Lower Van Houten Street, opposite Cross Street and Mill Street, and there were literally hundreds and hundreds of workers there, and the owners of the mills had contacted the Patterson Police Department to break up the strike, and the policemen came down on horses, and I remember walking the picket line hand in hand with my father, and the police ran through the picket lines to disperse us. It was something like today where you see a mob activity. Mm-hmm. And yes, it did have an effect on me. The effect that it had on me, that it was indecent not to provide a decent wage so that the living conditions would be improved. And the other effect it had on me, that individually persons couldn't accomplish much, but as a group, and let me use the word union again in this sense, that as a group you could accomplish a great deal. We learned through that cooperation, and we learned the power of a group as opposed to individuality, and also we learned that that power could sway elections in our favor, which is true today.
Okay, I'm going to back up a little from some of these questions. I just, beforehand, was your father involved? So beforehand, your father wasn't involved in any unions or anything, it just the strike happened and then your family got involved? Or beforehand, do you know if he was like a member of a union at all beforehand?
No. In those days, people were individuals. There was no union. Mm-hmm. What you did in order to survive a job, you had to be damn good at your work, because the owners would always check out your production. Mm-hmm. It was your skills as a weaver, and the quantity that you produced is what kept you in that job.
Okay. And did he talk at home, or like how did you get involved in going to the?
Well, it was general conversation between his brother and the three of us lived together. The three men. My father, his brother, which is my uncle, and myself, because we had no female survivors mm-hmm. in our family. So we bonded together and lived together, and the talk and the at mealtime was always what was happening in the shops and the mm-hmm. mills.
And so did you want to go to the strike as well? Or
I went to the strike, yeah. Sure. I was helping my daddy. Mm-hmm. I was walking side by side with my daddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was very upset that the police were swinging their clubs and charging their horses through our ranks. But you had to get out of the way or you would get hurt.
Mm-hmm. And were there other children at the strike, too?
I don't recall.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't recall.
Okay. And what was it like when the police came through? Like, how did people react to that?
The same way people would react today. As you know, the people charging into people that are protesting in the streets of New York and any place else in the city, one would be angry. You know, there was anger in there. Mm-hmm. Why did they take the side of the owners? Why didn't they peacefully ask us mm-hmm. to get out of the way? Or why didn't they permit us to march peacefully like they do today? In those days, they didn't let you do that.
Okay. And after the strike, did anything change?
I can't really answer that. I think maybe they got a couple of pennies more per yards that they weave. Mm-hmm. See, in those days, you didn't get paid by the hour. You got paid by the quantity of fabric you weaved. You got paid by the yards.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. But nothing like visibly, like your dad didn't come home with like bags more money or anything, or the hours didn't change or anything?
I recall my father and my uncle coming home extraordinarily tired because mm-hmm. of the heavy work that the heavy work that they had to do. There was no relief in those days. You didn't mm-hmm. take a lunch hour. There was no such thing.
Yeah.
You didn't take a break. And you went to the toilet. You had to shut your machine down. If you shut your machine down, there was no production.
Mm-hmm. So you're paid by production.
You got paid, you got paid by it.
Okay. So what was it like for you growing up in Patterson?
Well, I had as you know, I grew up during the Great Depression, mm-hmm. and there was a tremendous amount of deprivation in my household because there was no work during the Depression. The silk mills shut down. And it was very difficult to survive. We didn't have the full meals as other people may have had that were earning money. clothing. You wore the same pants until it wore out, or the same socks. You'd go down to 5 and 10, and for 5 cents you'd buy a new pair of socks and put them on. Or you'd buy a pair of pants for $2. And when that wore out, you went and bought another pair for $2. And little by little, as it got worse, we finally had to go on what they call relief in those days. Today they call it welfare. And in those days, the relief was very, very strict. In order to get food, you had a document. There were three colored pages. One was pink, one was white, and one was blue. And printed on that page was exactly what you were permitted to have. You couldn't have and no soda, none of the goodies, and no cigarettes, and everybody smoked in those days. And when you went to the Acme market or the A&P market, there was a checklist. And as you purchase your canned food or whatever, that list was checked off. You signatured the papers. You got one copy. One copy went to the welfare board, and the other copy remained, I think, with the purveyor. It was a terrible, terrible time. I learned how to survive by my wits. I lived in the streets, and I, whatever opportunity there was to earn 5 cents or 10 cents to go to the movie, what I did was scrounge soda bottles and milk bottles, and I got a 5 cents return on a soda bottle and 2 cents on a milk bottle, you looked, went to the junkyard to find copper, or you saved your papers. They paid you 5 cents for 100 pounds of paper in those days. And
just
I remember
to bring back the paper, or
saved the newspapers.
Okay.
Or if anybody put the newspapers out on the curb, you took it, made a bundle, and tried to sell it there. I remember when I was living downtown, the Passaic River was clear water, absolutely clear. You could look down and see the bottom. And this is when I lived in downtown. I would go in, to get movie money, I would go to the Passaic River, and there were pools of goldfish there. And I would catch goldfish with my bare hands and sell it to the 5 and 10 for 5 cents or 10 cents, and that's how I got my movie money.
And how old were you at that time?
About 13, 14.
Yeah.
And one day, my father got me a job working at the fruits and vegetables store on Washington Street. Washington Street in Patterson at that time was known for its tremendous market. The entire street was all vegetable stores, fruit stores, chicken stores, and whatnot. I had worked from 8 in the morning to midnight for $1, and I was told not to touch the fruit.
But you were working at the fruit store.
I was working at the fruit store. Then when I became 16, well, this while I'm going to school.
So you had work from 8 in the morning to midnight?
To midnight, on a Saturday.
Okay.
Saturday only, one day a week.
Yeah.
And when I was 16, on Broadway and Main Street, a store opened, a New York guy came in and opened up a little stand, a hot dog stand, free root beer with every hot dog. I worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for $10.
And during the summer or after, did you drop
full time? It was during the summer, yeah, full time.
Yeah. Was that, that wasn't Libby's hot dog stand,
no,
was
no,
it?
No,
okay.
That was Libby.
That wasn't Libby. Libby's was a very famous place, hot dog place. People from all over the state used to come over.
Where that is.
Yeah, Libby's isn't so good anymore.
And Libby's hot dogs was 10 cents.
Yeah.
And French fries was 10 or a nickel? 10.
Yeah, cheap. Everything was under a quarter.
I was so poor. I remember going with friends from school that would go to Libby's for a hot dog. Their parents were working. And I would stand outside the store and watch them because I didn't have any money to buy a hot dog. I couldn't even buy a soda. I had no money. So I just stood outside and watched my friends eat their hot dogs.
Yeah.
And when they came out, we got together again.
Uh-huh.
The Depression had a tremendous impact on me that resulted to this day.
I know what you're going to say. You still almost live the same way now, that you don't throw anything away.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right, I do the same thing.
I remember 2 weeks ago I had a hole in my stocking. So my wife took the stockings and she threw them in the garbage. I went back in the garbage and took the stocking out and got a needle and thread and I sewed the hole.
That's my father used to sew all the socks. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
If you had a tear in your clothes, you sewed it. You never threw nothing away. You have no idea the horrors of that depression, of what the people went through that were starving. We were literally starving during the depression. And in 1937, I graduated grammar school. And at the time...
What school did you graduate? Number two?
At the time, the government instituted a program called... Youth Administration. Those are the two words I remember. Youth Administration. And it was instituted, I think, by who was president then?
Roosevelt.
Yeah. It was under Roosevelt's administration. I can't recall. I was going to say Hoover, but it's not. And it was 50 cents a day for cleaning out classrooms in school. You could get a job by going to the office and telling them that you wanted to work under the Youth Administration. And I had four classrooms I swept out every day, and I had to clean the blackboard and smack the erasers together to get the chalk out, sweep up the floor of the classroom, and set the shades. And one day we had a terrible snowstorm, and it shut down the entire city of Patterson. And the word went out that the high school was looking for shovelers to shovel the sidewalk in the snow. So I reported to the office and told them I wanted to work, and I shoveled snow all day.
They didn't have snow blowers in those days.
No, they didn't have snow blowers.
They had human blowers.
I believe I got $2. Mm.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, I was going to say back then wasn't that a lot of
you
money.
You were overpaid.
Yeah.
And I had a friend of mine whose father worked at the Patterson Morning Call, and I asked him.
That was a newspaper.
That was one of the leading morning newspapers in Patterson. In Patterson, there were two leading papers: the Patterson Evening News
and the
Patterson
Evening
Morning Call. And my friend was working at the paper during vacation. And he was getting $4 a week to wrap papers up, to put them in the mail back, in the mail bags, so they could send the mail bags onto the train for the rural communities that didn't have stores to buy the paper. So he got me that job, and I was working from 10 at night to 3 in the morning while I was going to school. Then I found another job in the Patterson Evening News as a truck driver. They were paying big bucks. I was getting $6 a week driving a truck. So between the Patterson News and the Morning Call, and they took out income tax, I went home with something like $7.
I can repeat the same thing Jerry said in different
locations. Unbelievable.
Yeah. But then that was really big bucks, though, right?
Well, you were happy just to be working. That's an image. And like he did, see, he jumped from one little job to another little job to any place where you make a buck. I was a little same way, in a way.
Okay.
I used to lie like hell about my age.
Yeah, me too.
I was an usher at the State Theater.
Oh, wow,
yeah. They kept asking me for my working papers. I said, I'm getting them, until they finally said, hey, you're fired. I was 13 years old.
So I was in Central High School at the time, going to school and working those two jobs. It got to the point where my eyeballs were down to my feet. I was so tired. Anyway, came to...
You tell her what our high school looked like.
Now, back in 1939, while I was still in school, and I was, as you know, we were still in the Depression, and food was a big thing, and I saw an opportunity, if I joined the Army, I could get 3 meals a day. Ooh. Chamber of Commerce? Never looked that good.
I know.
Yeah. So I joined the Army. I was underage, and I was in the infantry for a while, and somebody found out how old I was, and they reported to company commander, and they kicked me out of the Army. But at least I had some good food for a couple of
days. So... Were there any social activities that you participated in?
Oh, yeah. After I started working,
You know, people have told me.
1939. So when I was 17, 18, Patterson, Passaic, the city of Passaic was noted for its entertainment, tremendous entertainment, great athletic town and a great social town. And I started going to dances, and I became expert at dancing. I went to dancing 3-4 times a week, and there were activities at Hinchcliffe Stadium. There was always something going on in Patterson and Clifton and Passaic.
Okay, what do you remember going to at Hinchcliffe?
Hinchcliffe Stadium was the home of a semi-professional baseball team. I think that was it, the Black Yankees, Al?
Yeah.
I remember.
Black Yankees, New York Cuban used to come in.
I remember seeing that.
The Negro League.
Yeah, the Negro League. I used to go there all the time, and there was football, semi-professional football there. One of the outstanding football players I remember at that time was Ozzie Simmons, was a semi-pro football player.
Well, the Patterson Panthers.
Patterson Panthers was the Patterson team.
Weren't they a farm team for the New York Giants? I think they were for the New York Giants.
But I don't know that for sure.
Yeah, I think they were.
Yeah, Patterson Panthers, right. They used to play the Providence Boilermakers.
I shag fly boys with Larry Doby.
Yeah?
Yeah. Remember, he was the second black kid.
Yeah, Patterson was a fantastic town for social activity. Uh-huh. Patterson at the time was a very beautiful town.
Safe. And you mentioned
safe.
Okay, and you mentioned that the Passaic River was really clear back then. Did you go swimming?
People were talking about going swimming in
the tubs.
Matter of fact, your grandfather and I used to go swimming in a place called the Tubs. Which is located on...
It's right down from the falls there.
Ellison Street yesterday. By the Passaic Falls. Mm-hmm. I used to swim a skinny dip in the Passaic River, and I swam under the Passaic Falls.
Under them?
Under the falls.
I never did that one. Yeah. I got under the falls.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was our swimming pool.
Mm-hmm. That was it.
Yeah. And it was all clean then?
It was very clean.
Well, even if it was, we thought it was clean.
Yeah. And Patterson used to have a swimming pool called Circle Pool.
Right.
It was located at the end of Market Street.
On the Circle. That's why.
Around the Circle on Market Street. It was called the Circle Pool. And for 25 cents, you could go swimming.
Yeah.
It was an Olympic-sized pool. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I think the...
You should get a good crowd there.
The Olympic swimming champion and movie star at that time was Johnny Weissmuller.
Right.
I think he came and swam there one time back in...
he played Tarzan in the movies.
Yeah. Well, what year was that? It was the year the movie Captain Blood came out with Errol Flynn. I think that was 1935.
That's what those guys.
So, yeah,
but the 25 cents was a fortune in those days, let me tell you.
So would you only do that on like really hot days?
The hot days you swam in the Passaic River because you didn't have the money to go to Circa Pool.
Yeah.
The Circa Pool were the rich people. Right. That's what they are.
Yeah, so did you ever get a chance to go there?
Circle Pool?
Circle Pool,
yeah. I went there once. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Nice. Was it worth it?
Yes, it was. I didn't want to leave. They threw me out.
Did you ever go to any of the East Side Central games?
East Side and Central, that was the town rivalry. It was like the Giants and the Dodgers, or it was like...
Packed house on Thanksgiving Day.
It was wall-to-wall students on the East Side Central Thanksgiving Day. That was the yearly activity the whole town looked forward
That's
to.
That's right.
And at the time, just before game day, the night before game day, they would have torchlight parades. The students from Central would get in their cars with the, what do you call them, torches? Roadside torches.
Flares.
They light flares and whatnot, and we would drive up with convoys of cars, maybe 40, 50 cars, running through the east side section, and the east side students would do the same thing. They'd come downtown Patterson through the central section. It was
a big thing. It was a
huge rivalry, but there was no animosity there. It was just good sportsmanship between students of two schools. There were no shootings and bombings like today.
Yeah.
Remember, you also had like that Richmond, that Poorman's Hill. That once it packed, you could see inside the stadium and that little knoll.
What the heck was that hill called?
I think it was called Poorman's Hill or something like that. I got on that hill a couple times.
and Patterson had its own radio station called WPAT.
That's right.
Yeah. And the MC of that station was a guy by the name of Steve Ellis.
You remember all that stuff. I remember the names, definitely.
I know that a lot of famous people came to Patterson.
Lived in Patterson. Other than Larry Doby, one of the outstanding athletes was a boxer by the name of Pat Comiskey that fought Joe Louis for the championship in 1944, I think it was. I was overseas when he fought him. As a matter of fact, I was hitchhiking in Patterson one day in early 1940s, and Pat Comiskey was a contender for the championship, the heavyweight championship, picked me up and gave me a ride downtown.
You know where a lot of those guys trained?
Huh?
Over at the Lincoln Club. It was the Lincoln Club on West Broadway.
Yeah, so a lot of them were training at Lincoln Club.
Watch those guys. A lot of those guys trained.
Who else was there?
Yeah, there was a lot of good boxers that came to
Patterson, too. Let me think now who they were.
We got the famous Lou Costello.
Costello. Pearl White.
Yeah.
It's tough to recall.
But you had
a lot of movie stars and athletes came from Patterson.
You had met the boxer when you were hitchhiking. What was that like being picked up by?
Oh, I thought it was the greatest thing because he was a contender for the heavyweight boxing thing.
Yeah, were you in a uniform at that time?
No,
huh?
It was before the war. And Patterson had Patterson Evening News had sponsored a boxing program for the community called the Diamond Gloves.
Oh, right. I forgot about that. Diamond Gloves. I remember that. Oh, yeah.
So what was the...
And that was held in the Hitchcock Stadium. What year was that?
That was like every year they had that?
Yeah, that was being held every year.
Yeah, but I don't know when the start. I think it's...
Well, it had to be in the mid-30s.
It was in the 30s.
Yeah, somewhere in the mid-30s. Late 30s.
And it went into 1940, remember.
It was a big thing.
It was like the Golden Gloves of New York.
Right.
New York City had the Golden Gloves, and Patterson had the Diamond Gloves.
Diamond Gloves, okay.
And the each winner would receive a gold ring with a gold glove, and in the center of the gold glove was a diamond chip.
Okay, so...
I can't think of this.
Is there anything else that you remember, like that you and your friends did for fun or whatever that you want to talk more about?
There weren't a lot of things they did for fun.
Well, you know, there was no television in those days. What we did a great deal was listen to radio programs on Sundays or in the evenings. There were great stories, great comedians, and tremendous, tremendous news analysts.
What was your base? Did you have a baseball team you liked?
My favorite baseball team was the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Me too. Brooklyn Dodgers. I used to come home and listen to Red Barber.
Exactly.
There's a little radio like that on the stand. The first thing I did, drop my books, and I was saved by that radio like this from my ear. And my father used to break up because, you know, the Red Barber's going 2-1, 3-2. My father always, he didn't know shit about baseball. he was going 3-2, 4-2, 2-1. What are you listening to?
What is this?
What's your number?
Did you go into New York a lot? I know.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I became an aficionado of New York. I used to hang around Times Square and 52nd Street. Okay. What drew me to 52nd Street was the nightclubs there, because in 1937, one of my graduation present for grammar school was to go live with my cousin up in Watertown, Massachusetts, which is right next to Boston. And in Watertown, Massachusetts, I made acquaintance of several musicians that were five or more years older than me, but they were terrific musicians. And they came down, they got a job in New York City working at a nightclub called The Famous Door on 52nd Street.
Okay.
And they were written up in the New York papers by a famous correspondent called Walter Winchell.
Okay.
When Walter Winchell wrote about them, they became very famous. And it was at this club I met several movie stars that came to listen to the kids. Several movie stars would come and listen to this combination. Uh-huh. And out of this combination, because of their talents, two of the musicians relocated to Hollywood and were writing musical scores for the movies.
Okay. Did they have a name for the group, the combinations? Or?
I can't remember.
Okay.
Yeah. I wish I had these questions ahead of time. I could have thought about it.
Okay, don't worry about it.
Oh.
Don't worry about it. Okay.
And then, and associated with that group was a sister of one of the guys, and she became a vocalist for Woody Herman's orchestra. Her name was Frances Wayne.
Okay. Woody Herman in the Herd.
Yeah, and she, her... One of the outstanding songs that she recorded was
It's okay.
A lot of the good singers came out of the band.
Okay, so.
And I remember after the war, Woody Herman was playing at the Paramount Theater. This was in December 1945. And I asked the guy I used to work for in the Patterson News had a daughter. I asked her for a date to go over to the Paramount Theater to meet Frances Wayne. So she was kind of thrilled. We went over to the Paramount Theater, and I went to the stage door and told the stage door that I was a cousin of Frances Wayne and I wanted to see her. So he called upstairs and... they confirmed it, and I was escorted upstairs to the Paramount Theater, and I met Woody Herman in person. And when they went downstairs to play their part at the theater, my date and I were escorted down to the stage, and we sat off stage and watched the performance of the band. And later on, they also played. In those days, big bands not only played in the theater, but they also had a nightclub engagement at the same time. So that evening, we went to a nightclub called the 400 Club, which was an outstanding club at the time, big time. And I took my date there, and we sat at the table right next to the dance floor. As a matter of fact, I got the picture in my house of Francis Wayne, and Woody Harmon was playing. And the whole night cost me $10 for dinner, hat check, and the drinks.
And the drinks. All right, so what jobs did you have in Patterson, like going back to Patterson?
Well, as I told you, when I was going to school, I worked as a mail, what they call a mail wrapper at the Patterson Morning Call. I was a truck driver at the Patterson Evening News. And later on, I became what they called a fly boy at the press. The fly boy at the press's job is when the newspapers come down the chute, you picked up the newspapers and put them on a truck, a hand truck that would go to the wrappers to wrap. So I had that job. And it was at that time the war was on, and I quit my job and enlisted in the Army and didn't come back home until December 1945. When I went to get my job back at the Morning Call, they told me they gave it to somebody else. And I was very upset about that because the government had indicated that the employers would give you, it was not a law.
That was against the law, I think.
Really, that was not a big protection.
No.
They didn't guarantee a damn thing.
That's
us.
Right. So I was out of work. And I was 45, 23 years old. So I went back to the Patterson Evening News where I knew the boss very well, and he gave me the job as driving a truck again. And his nephew had opened up a furniture store and asked me to work there, so I worked as a in the furniture store for a while. And I had a communications background from the Army, and my friend that I made in the Army was working for the Western Electric in California. And he telephoned me and said that they had a lot of work to come on out there. So I left Patterson in 1946. I went to Los Angeles, and I got a job with the Western Electric, which is a subsidiary of Bell Telephone. So I stayed in California for 6 months. I couldn't survive because I was making $39 a week. And I had paid my room rent, my food. By the time the end of the week came, I had 10 cents left. So I had to go, I had to come back to New Jersey. And they transferred me at my own cost back to the Newark headquarters of Western Electric. So I came back to Patterson and late 1946, and I start working in the Bell Telephone Company in Patterson at the on Ellison Street called Sherwood, and on Fair Street called the Armory Four, and that's where I met my wife.
Armory Four.
Met her at Western Electric.
I used to work for Western Electric.
And you met her there.
Yeah. Well, we used to do the installation of the switchboards, the cables, the poles. We did everything.
All right. And your wife was from Patterson as well?
My wife was Patterson, and she was a supervisor for Bell Telephone.
All right.
A telephone operator. And I saw her, and we fell in love, and got married.
All right. And what other jobs did you have in Patterson after Western Electric?
You probably stayed with them for a long time, right?
No.
No?
No.
Why don't you hit those big companies?
The reason why I left Western Electric, I had just got back home from the, from being away. And they wanted to ship me out again.
Okay.
Yeah. So I said, oh, I just got back. So it was either take the job or quit.
Yeah.
So I quit the job. So, and at that time, Curtis Wright Corporation was starting a new division called the Electronics Division. They were making flight simulators. And I went up there and got a job as a wireman. That was in that was in Fairfield, New Jersey, on Route 46. Yeah, yeah. The building is still there.
Yeah, right. I was just going to say.
So I stayed with Curtis Wright for 13 years. I got married, stayed with Curtis Wright for 13 years, became a foreman. And after 1963, I left Curtis Wright and I went with Singer Kirfa. I became an engineering administrator. Mm-hmm. You want this?
Sure, one? Yeah, go ahead.
And when I was with Singer Kirfa, we had a program called MMRM. It was a Army, it was a defense job, called Mid Mobile Range Ballistic Missile. Employed thousands of people.
And where was this?
In West Patterson.
In West Patterson,
McBride
Avenue.
Okay. And what had happened, I think it was about 3 months into the program, the program was canceled by the Defense Department. And there was an associate company called Link Aviation in Binghamton, New York, came down to interview the people that were laid off.
And to go up to New York?
And they had they went through everybody's resume and they saw that I had experience at Curtis Wright in the simulators. And they offered me a job up in Binghamton, New York to work for them because they were in the simulator business.
Yes.
I didn't particularly want to go to New York, but I had no job.
Now
I had
you were married at this time.
I was married. I had a young boy in high school, Passaic Valley High School. And it was either stay home and take money from the, what the hell is that called? Unemployment.
That was only for like 6 months, though.
Yeah.
It's not like today, 99 weeks.
Yeah. So I took the job up in Binghamton, New York. So I lived up there for about a year or so. And they needed a representative in the Bronx because they got a contract for Apollo, the Apollo program.
Yeah.
And one of the contractors for the Apollo program for Link was located in the Bronx. And they knew I was from the New York, New Jersey area, and they wanted somebody that were familiar with the area. And they asked me if I would take the job as a representative staying at this company. And I jumped at the situation because it would bring me back home. So I came and stayed there for a couple of years.
And working on the Apollo mission?
Yeah, I worked on the Apollo program, yeah. And what had happened then, they transferred me back from Link down to West Patterson at the Singer Company.
Yeah.
And I went into contract administration there. I stayed there until 13 years. And I got an offer to go with ITT in Nutley, so I went to ITT and stayed there a couple of years.
All right. Was West Patterson, the Singer Company, were they involved in the Apollo mission at all?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
When I was with I was with Link Aviation at the time, Link Aviation also became affiliated with Singer later on. And since I was a representative at the Bronx, they made me a business manager, and I was shipped to Houston, Texas.
Okay.
And I had to interface with the astronauts in Houston, Texas for my company. So I became very well acquainted with all the astronauts.
Yeah, wow.
Neil Armstrong and all of them guys. Yeah, we used to go to lunch a lot.
So you were transferred to Houston?
Yeah.
You lived there?
For a while. I was bouncing back and forth. And then they decided at the time they were going to build Cape Canaveral for the moon shoot. And Cape Canaveral at that time was a swamp. So they sent me down there from my company as a site manager to see where we could build couple of buildings. So I was bouncing back and forth between Binghamton, West Patterson, Houston, Texas, and Cape Canaveral, which became Cape Kennedy. and I was never home. Boy, was this pissed.
Oh, man.
That's another story.
I thought I bounced around. I didn't bounce around.
So I was traveling at the time from Texas. It was Braniff Airlines. It wasn't Continental. It was Braniff Airlines. And I became well known throughout the airplane circus, flying all over the country. And I started flying damn near complimentary first class. So I stayed there until after the successful moonshot.
Okay.
A matter of fact, I was so familiar with Grumman Aerospace. We were subcontracted Grumman. To them, they were so grateful that I helped them out a lot of time. Mm-hmm. That when they were on going up to the moon chute, they had a huge plaque.
Mm-hmm.
And all the guys that were from worked on the program from Grumman had signatured it. And they asked me if I would sign it because they were going to put it on the moon.
It's unreal.
And I signed it, and my name is on the moon.
So were you the only person from West from who was stationed out of Patterson to be on that plaque, or do you?
I don't know anybody else that signed it, to tell you the truth. Yeah, it was very interesting. The work was tremendously interesting. It took me into areas I would never dream of going into, and I was sitting at many of the configuration meetings at Houston, and I was at Mission Control, you know, that room where all the guys sitting there watching.
Yeah.
That's a very small room, you know, very small.
And what was...
It was very thrilling working with the astronauts.
Yeah, I was going to say, what were they like personally?
Oh, they were terrific guys, great guys. With all of their... persona.
Yeah.
They were really regular down-to-earth guys. None of them were haughty.
Yeah.
You know, like the musicians today.
Yeah.
I don't think those guys, because they volunteered for something.
They were great guys to tell. We used to go to dinner with them and lunch with them, you know. And great bunch of guys.
Yeah.
And let's see. I stayed there. Where'd I go from there? Oh, I went back to ITT.
Did you?
Yeah, I stayed there from 1975 to 1977. I didn't like that. I left them, and I went with General Precision, General Public Utilities. They made the Three Mile Island.
Okay. So you built... Three Mile Island.
I went there as a contract man. I didn't particularly like the work. And when the debacle happened at Three Mile Island, I was scheduled to go down to Three Mile Island, spend a couple of years there to record all the complaints from all the people that were in that area. Yeah. And I couldn't see myself sitting there for a couple of years writing about farmers' cows.
Yeah.
So I left there and I went to New York. I worked at the World Trade Center.
Really?
Yeah, I worked there for a couple of years on the 95th floor.
Wow.
And I was sent to Caracas, Venezuela, because we had an aluminum plant that was being built there. And my job was to contact each of the suppliers to determine where they were in their schedule. I stayed there for about a month, and then I had to go to Germany, Switzerland, Belgium, and England to determine how their schedules were going. Uh-huh. That was a very enjoyable job, but I was traveling all the time, and I had an expense account of $1,000 a week, and I was never home. And obviously,
I know, I was just going to say that. Yeah. It's got to be tough.
And my home life suffered because I wasn't home. So I decided to leave that, and I went with Foster Wheeler, which was a construction plant in
they're locally, right? Over here, right? Foster Wheeler?
Where the hell were they? Livingston.
Okay.
I stayed there several years. I enjoyed that job very, very well. And from Livingston, I went back to ITT because ITT had a tremendous program in a retrofit of the B-52 bomber. And I retired from ITT in 1989.
Okay.
Is that Nutley?
Clifton. And after I retired, I became a consultant for Bath Ironworks, representing the shipbuilding company. Uh-huh. I did that for a couple of years. And I became a consultant for an aircraft company. And I finally decided that I had enough. That was it.
Yeah.
You really bounced around a lot. Holy gosh.
So you moved out of Patterson.
I moved out of Patterson when we got married in 1950. 50? Yeah. No. Mm-hmm. Not 57. 53.
Okay.
And I moved out of Patterson to West Patterson in 1957. I stayed in West Patterson 25 years.
Okay.
And in 1977, we bought a house in Tawako.
Okay.
That's how I got here.
Yeah. Okay.
So you moved out of Patterson in 53. I moved out in 54.
Yeah, so...
Where were you? Oh, you were up on Temple Hill.
Yeah, up on Clifton Street.
You see it now.
Oh, I can imagine. I wanted to take a ride there yesterday.
Yeah, you got to go in with the Marines up there.
So,
really?
So,
oh my God.
Did you just move out of Patterson because of having a job outside of Patterson, or?
I moved out of Patterson because I found a house in Tawako.
Yeah.
That's how why I moved.
Yeah.
No, I moved out of Patterson because when we got married, my brother-in-law found rooms for me in West Patterson.
Okay.
Because we were living with my mother-in-law for about a year.
Okay.
So I had to get out of there.
Yeah. Okay.
That's how I got to West Patterson.
Because
at the end of World War II, during World War II, or at the beginning of World War II, there was a huge aircraft company in Patterson called Curtiss-Wright Corporation.
Yeah.
They made aircraft engines. And when the war broke out, or just prior to the breakout of war, rather in 1940 and 41, they had contracts to provide engines for Great Britain for their fighter aircraft. When we got into the war, Curtiss-Wright needed thousands of employees to work there.
Mm-hmm.
And I had tried to get a job there, but since I was draft bait, I was 19, I think, they wouldn't give me a job.
Yeah.
But what had happened was people from all over the country migrated into the Patterson area because their certain Patterson area was booming with work.
Yeah.
Going back to now, when the war ended, these people that were here in Patterson that came from the south, from wherever, from even depressed areas, would not leave Patterson.
Yeah.
So us soldiers coming back, we couldn't find rooms.
No housing. Yeah.
So if you got married, or if you wanted to be independent, you couldn't. You had to go back home and live with your parents.
Yeah.
So that's why I left. That's how I had to live with my mother-in-law when I got married.
Yeah.
And when my brother-in-law found rooms in West Patterson, I jumped at the chance. It was only 2.5 rooms.
Yeah.
So I had to get the hell out of it.
Well, that's all we did in East Patterson. It was actually a converted house. The upstairs was converted to an apartment.
Yeah.
Like we said, we only had like 1.5 rooms or something like that.
You don't know how lucky you are.
I know.
Yeah. So.
Oh, it's a complete difference.
So did you ever want to get involved in the labor movement like your father was?
No. No, this is the type of work with his job. He wasn't going to be involved with labor.
Yeah. And you never wanted to go and work in the mills or anything?
No.
Definitely not.
No.
Okay, so have you returned to Patterson recently?
Oh, I go down to Patterson every now and then to go back to the old neighborhood and see what it looks like.
And how is that?
It looks like a war zone.
Cross Street didn't look bad. When I crossed, I was going down Patterson.
Cafe Roma used to be there.
You're right,
It's still there, but there's nothing.
Nothing.
It was all Italian there. Now it's all Hispanics. Nothing's there now.
Yeah, the Patterson Pastry, what we have, it looked like they took two storefronts they made out of our one front. I think.
You see St. Michael's Church? You see St. Michael's
Church? I never got a chance to glance at it. I went through a red light. I was looking and watching, and I was going right through a red light.
Terrible.
Yeah.
It didn't look that as bad as I thought it would. But of course, like my nephew said, you got to go, once you get past the city hall, now you got a different problem.
Well, that's what I was going to do. If we had a nice day, you'd take a ride over to the east side or through Godwin Avenue, all the black section. You see, it's terrible.
It's got to be. Mm-hmm. It's got to be.
Marcus Street. Do you guys see any like parallels though, like with immigrants moving to Patterson now, whereas like your families were like all immigrating to Patterson back then? Like, do you guys see any parallels in that, or?
I can't consider a parallel in something like that. No.
No, first of all, number one,
the demographics have changed.
Yeah. Number one, I think the cities definitely is safe. When we were young.
Yeah.
I was able to walk through a black neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Me too.
On the way from the bakery over to Cliff Street. Nobody bother you.
No.
I used to go to nightclubs, black nightclubs, just to listen to some of the music.
Yeah. That's what we used to do.
Uh-huh.
We had no problem. The blacks had no problem with us, and we had no problem with them.
Yeah.
You're right.
It's a different ball game, let me tell you.
Yeah.
It really is.
Shit, today.
Day and night.
You got enough now, Tuts?
Yeah. Anything else you want to say?
No.
Are you good? Okay.